Hello, and welcome to Preprints in Motion. This is the only show bringing you the freshest science directly from the hottest new scientists. So join us as we discuss science, preprints, and academia. So hit that subscribe button and join us every first and third Wednesday for a brand new episode, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. But for now, let's get into the show. This week we sit down with Dr. Bart Voss, talk about his recent preprint designing a high-resolution Lego-based microscope for an educational setting. Welcome to the show. Thank you very, very much for joining us. And just before we get started, we like to have a little chat with a bit of kind of fun background, which is why we ask, give us a fun fact. And I really liked your fun fact. So you like to seek science in everyday life. Could you just explain a little bit what you mean by that?
I think I have a certain curiosity by which I try to look for the scientific explanation for things that happen in everyday life. So, for example, when you are wearing sunglasses, they are often polarized, and that leads to very interesting effects. So, of course, you know, when you are at a 3D movie, you need polarized glasses in order to see the two different screens that are basically projected at the same time. But there are many more things that are polarized in life. So take, for example, a look at just the light that is reflected on the screen of a car, the window of a car, and you will see that when you tilt your head, you can suddenly see inside the car. So people would be hidden by reflection from one polarity, suddenly show up when people are wearing sunglasses that are polarized. And that's something I find fascinating and very interesting.
So you're one of these people who are full of fun facts?
Maybe, yes.
Great. That's what you want. So the other thing I thought that was really cool is you write poetry.
I do, yes.
And you wrote a poem for each chapter of your thesis.
I did, yes. So here again, maybe I can shortly explain the rules of this poem. It's defined with mathematical strictness, 8 lines, 44 syllables, any syllable more and you're out of the game. And yeah, within these constraints, I find a lot of freedom to play with language, to play with rhyme, to play with words, and in the end, to also convey a scientific message to a wider audience. In the end, I think that these introductory poems may be the most well-read part of my thesis.
I mean, at least somebody reads some of it, right? Somebody has to.
Yes, but I think most PhD theses are read by the supervisor, the person who wrote it, and then some members of the committee, and maybe a few people who join the lab afterwards. It surprises me if the number rises above 10.
Yeah. Yeah, mine is probably sat on 4 people. 5 if you include me.
Exactly. Well, you wrote it.
In fact, I haven't even got a copy of my thesis. I never printed one out. I think I was sick of looking at it by that point, so I just hands off, give up. So with me today, I have Dr. Bart Voss, who is a postdoc at the Institute of Cell Biology at the University of Munster. And we're going to be talking about a really cool preprint that I think is really appropriate for this podcast as our first episode, actually. And this is designing a high-resolution Lego-based microscope for an educational setting. Now, I guess the obvious question is, why Lego?
I think there are many answers. The obvious answer is because it's very cool. Because Lego is such a versatile system that we've all played with, that some of us might even still be playing with. And what I like is to push boundaries, not only in science, but also things that could potentially be used for science.
And I'm looking at the design now. I'm going to try and describe it. I love how it looks. So it's a tower with a gap in the middle, which is, I presume, that's where your sample goes.
It's just a spacer. The stage is underneath the sample. You see maybe on the picture a small slit. That's where the microscope glass, the microscopy slide goes in.
And presumably you can, It's Lego, so once you've got your main structure, you can kind of play around and make it look however you want, right?
Of course, that's something we also emphasized in the preprint. And if you think you have a better design, please share it with us.
I mean, my design, to be honest, would just be a tower with a lot of fluff around it. I'd build like a castle around the tower just to make it fun, right?
Well, all the designs are on GitHub, so you can edit them, you can upload a new fork, so by all means.
And so, when you're designing a Lego microscope, what kind of resolution can you get down to with this?
So in the end, we're quite close to the physical limits. So we are using a smartphone camera lens. They are very good and practically for free. And then we also use a plastic lens, and combined, these two lenses give a magnification of around 250 times. And we have a resolution of around half a micrometer.
So this actually has real world use then, right? At that resolution.
This is very close to what we can get in the lab. Of course, a microscope in the lab is 100 times more expensive, and reasons for that is very simple. You can just get better images. But what we can see is essentially the same.
Yeah, so one of our objectives for the microscopes we primarily use is about £60,000.
60,000 times, that gets you 600 Lego microscopes.
It's not something you want to drop and break. It's a little bit terrifying every time you have to change it.
Well, that's another advantage of the Lego microscope. If you drop it and it breaks, you can just reassemble.
You can put it back together. And you can change the color, of course, right? It's just Lego bricks. You can make it as colorful and pretty as you like, which is great.
Exactly. Everything can be changed.
So you tried this out with school children, and you did a
Yes.
few you in the preprint, there's a few documented experiments you did. Could you talk a little bit about how that was and how the kids found it?
So in the end, this was all a plan that was made before Corona, and in the end, we had to change our plans. But the original idea was that we would provide these sets to a school class, where the students in group of say two, three would work on it. So we had devised building instructions. We had some basically help section to get them on the way if something wouldn't work. Questions on the way to explore the individual parts of a microscope. What does what and how does everything work together to in the end do what a microscope does. And then we had a few samples for them to play with. Some easy samples, for example, looking at a piece of paper and recognizing that everything is inverted when you use a microscope. But you can also get tiny, tiny objects, for example, a hair, and you can see the structure of a hair. You can take a bit of pond water and look at the unicellular organisms that live in there. So this is what we had in mind. In the end, when we wanted to do this, all schools were closed. So we gave them to individual children and let them work on it for a couple of days, and then we let them do a test to see what they learned.
I mean, that's a kind of fortunate that the schools were closed, because not only is it a good lockdown activity for people with kids, keeps them occupied for a bit, but it is actually a really good learning opportunity because you're combining a lot of different elements that. So I don't know how it is outside the UK, and Emma might want to fact check this to see if it's still true. But in the UK, at least when I was being brought up through education system, you're taught science as biology, chemistry, physics, maths. These are very separate things, and in our system, unless it's changed, those things aren't brought together. You never really get an appreciation that chemistry is biology and physics underlies
And
both of those.
physics, exactly.
Right? You just don't get that. Whereas what you've done here is you're bringing together biology, you're bringing together physics, optics, you've got a little engineering component to it because you're actually building the thing. That is a really, really cool way of bringing these things together. Do you think that's something that kind of comes across when the kids are putting it together and using it?
Well, we hope so. So in the end, also when I was in middle school, Microscopes were objects or were instruments that were that had needed to be handled with a lot of care. And what we want is to connect indeed the engineering part with the physical laws that govern optics. And doing so in a way where students don't need to be afraid of touching, of dropping anything, but just hands-on experience. The same goes for connecting physics and biology. We hope that by providing these simple experiments that basically anyone can do, the science becomes less abstract, becomes less scary and more accessible. And that was one of our primary goals.
The other thing you're doing here, and a big fan of microscopes, I use them all the time. My PhD was basically just microscopy. Don't know anything about the optics particularly. I just know how to press the buttons to make them do what I want to do. But one of the really great things about what you've kind of just said earlier, in that, one of the experiments you used was to use pond water, right? And that brings us right back to the early part of the history of microscopes, because Van Leeuwenhoek, of course, used pond water and river water. And, in Micrographia, his big microscopy book where he looked at all these different things we'd never looked at on that scale before, and then he sketched them out. That it brings it all right back to what, 17, 1600s. Somebody fact check me there. Brings us back a few hundred years. And it seems simple, right? A Lego microscope, really simple. But you're actually bringing about a lot of complex things, a lot of history, and it's such a good, useful tool for teaching.
Exactly. It's interesting that the first microscopes that indeed Van Leeuwenhoek made are very comparable to what we have nowadays in terms of what you can see. Of course, modern microscopes have a lot more capabilities. They have, well, they are way easier to operate, but in a sense, what you can really see with them has not changed.
Yeah, I am very thankful I don't have to grind down glass to get it just right.
He made the first microscopes because he was able to make the lenses. So that was his big contribution.
Yeah, he had the monopoly on that for quite a while because it was a very, very difficult technique to get the lenses just right. And yeah, he was one of the few people in the world who could actually do it well.
And of course, and that holds for any scientist to acknowledge that what you see is not necessarily a mystic, but potentially very interesting. So the little animals that he described were the first time that humanity saw unicellular life.
It's a step that I think, like walking on the moon, right? Everyone's going to know who Neil Armstrong is in like 200 years time, and Leeuwenhoek is probably one of those names that will also last that kind of distance because it is one of those landmark moments for humanity in a very grand kind of way. But it's something we'd never done before. It was the first time. So, you built a Lego microscope. Could we see a Lego lab in the future? Could you build other stuff out of Lego, like a Lego spectrometer, for example? Because it's kind of the same principle.
In the end, well, there are labs that use Lego in actual working setups. There's a lab in the UK that has several setups that incorporate some Lego parts. In the end, Lego also has its limitations. At some point, you have to acknowledge if you want to really push the boundaries of science, you have to step away from plastic bricks.
I just
But
want a
I can
Lego
very
lab.
well, I can very well imagine that something that combines education with science uses Lego.
Did you I think it was 2018, did you see the Lego light sheet microscope someone built?
Oh yes, they are
That was
amazing.
really cool. That might have been somebody, I think might have been in London, was part of that team. But yeah, that was super cool.
And again, it is amazing for demonstrating what a light sheet microscope does, how it differs from normal microscopy, and for illustration, it is perfect.
For basic experiments, it would probably be pretty good too. I during my PhD, I was lucky enough to use a light sheet for some Drosophila work, and we got really cool images out of that and movies that unfortunately never actually made it into the paper. And that's not true. Some of the images made it into a different paper, but having just a much cheaper version where you can run a fairly simple preliminary experiment on, is actually quite useful in the lab. It's, I think people don't necessarily appreciate how difficult it can be, especially as an early career researcher, where maybe you don't have any money at all, or you certainly don't have much money. And these kind of things are really useful because, yes, okay, you might not be able to do something as complicated as what I did with the light sheet, for example, but you can run fairly sophisticated experiments still.
Exactly. Well, it all boils down to recognizing what elements are crucial, what specifications you need, and then building around to get something that works.
And presumably, with what you've built, you could upgrade the components and the lenses and things to make it better.
Exactly. Yes. Of course, everything comes at a price. So if you want to pay more for your optics, you get glass optics. And then, of course, you are more vulnerable, but also better. So these plastic lenses we have, they're really not that good.
But they're not going to break as easily if you drop them.
Exactly. That is an advantage.
So, I mean, talking about cost, the next step would presumably be something like 3D printed components. Or would you keep it as Lego?
I think personally, I want to keep it as Lego. So of course you can 3D print basically everything these days. I think the advantage of Lego is that you can change the design any moment you want. You don't need to print something again. You can just detach a brick, put it somewhere else and see if it works or not. So I think the versatility, and that is also part of the teaching aspect, that you can just, well, really everything is modular. That is something that you get from Lego and not from 3D printing.
And the other thing, you know, looking at it, you've not actually used any blocks that are particularly expensive or unique, right? You've not used a bit of a Death Star in there. It's a whole pretty standard Lego blocks.
In the end, the most uncommon block is the block that contains the LED. But also these are available and it costs, I think it was something like €2 if you buy them.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm just, you know, thinking about lockdown still going on and just having some for your kids at home. This is, I think anyone, I don't know who listens, go out and buy them.
I don't think you need to have kids to build them.
I mean, to be fair, if I still had Lego lying around, in fact, I might have Lego at home. Yeah, I'd be straight on this. I'd have my little water sample under there right now. I might make one anyway, just for the lab. I've got nothing better to do these days. So, just moving slightly away from science, you posted this as a preprint.
Yes.
And I've noticed this is something you seem to do quite often. So why preprints?
Ooh, well, there are many answers to this question. And I think everyone you ask this question will give you a different answer. In our case, we just wanted it to be accessible to everyone. So in the case of the Lego microscope, we want it to be correct, the manuscript, but we also want it to be accessible. And I think that is something that you directly achieve by making a preprint on BioArchive, by posting a preprint on BioArchive.
So are you planning to publish this or are you keeping it as a preprint?
We are also going to publish it in a journal that is focused on biophysical research in an educational setting.
I think that BioArchive in particular is one of those, and maybe OSF in terms of the big service that publish or post these kind of things. They're really, really good for getting out there. And I mean, teachers aren't always great at keeping up with the scientific literature because, quite frankly, they have way too much to do as it is. But I do know teachers who do, you know, they do keep track of these kind of things and they do bring them into the classroom and use them, which is great.
So in terms of visibility, we also try to get this out to as many people as possible. So we also posted a Twitter video and it was also very well watched.
Yeah, I think between preprint servers and things like primarily Twitter, it's kind of doing a really good job of leveling the playing field a bit for not only the kind of research that gets attention, but the people who get the attention to you, right? You no longer have to be in this big, well-funded lab to get something that's really interesting out there and for people to actually see it.
Yeah, I think it's also, well, one of the things that we had in mind, that this is not something where a very select group of scientists say, well, interesting, we can do better, but that people with kids, people who are teaching, are actually seeing this.
This is, I can imagine this, so we I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but there's a big worldwide synthetic biology competition called iGEM. And this is exactly the kind of thing that would crop up in that. We actually took part in it a few years ago. And this is the kind of stuff you see. And it's a really, like, so they at the end of the competition, there's a big sort of in-person park in Boston. And you get teams from all around the world going to this. And they have it's a bit like a standard science conference. So you have talks, and you have a poster session. And I've never been to a poster session that is so much fun. The posters are not standard science posters. They're actually fun and engaging, and it's just such a great environment. And this is perfect for that. It's exactly the kind of thing someone they would use and show off and shout about. But yeah, it's kind of built on this idea of modular bits. So you might have a particular plasmid that someone designs, and that's their project for the competition. And then you get engineering type stuff like this. And it's such a great mesh of everything. So staying on the theme of preprints, one of the things you mentioned was that the issue we have in science or in academia is the parameters of success. And preprints, as I kind of mentioned, are a great way of getting at those parameters of success. So we're often judged by where we publish and how many papers we publish. And it's not a system that works.
How often these papers are cited. Those are basically the key parameters that define the success of an academic career.
So how do we fix that?
It's a problem because there are influential parties that benefit from the current system. Publishers benefit from a system where you basically pay to read the research that someone else paid to do. People who have already a successful career, they don't have much to gain by changing the system. And university boards, funding agencies, they need some parameter that puts some people as good and others as bad. So basically everyone in charge is not necessarily willing to fundamentally change the way that we fund academia.
Yeah, I shout about this a lot on Twitter. I don't think it wins me many friends.
And I think people are listening, but not the right people are listening.
Well, exactly. You know, I think it is that we need the top-down change, ultimately. And it's the sad thing, the thing I find really sad, is that it's such a simple and relatively easy change for someone at the top to make, to say, well, okay, we're seeing it a little bit, right, with funding bodies and grants. So when you apply for a grant now, preprints count as an output. So if you're a postdoc or a PhD student and you've not had enough time to get to a point where you can publish your papers, but maybe you've posted 3 or 4 preprints, they are now counted at least most of the places I'm aware of.
Still, this brings us to the salami technique. It is for your output better to cut up one complete piece of research into 3 individual tiny papers. 3 is more than 1.
Yeah.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This DC, BY, DD, XY nonsense driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
That's your answer for everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive. But is this not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows. And so, moving on from that, you moved from the Netherlands to Germany. So far, I've managed to only stay within the UK. I move slowly south, but that's as far as I get. How did you find that transition? Because, I mean, moving labs on its own is quite a big step, but moving labs and country?
I think in the end, moving labs is... Well, the big question is, what is the atmosphere of the lab where you end up? That is, in my opinion, maybe even more important than moving countries. Of course, moving countries sets certain boundary conditions, but what really defines whether I have fun in a lab or whether I think, okay, well, this is not exactly what I wanted, is the atmosphere, and that is created by not only the PI, but also the people who work there. And that is, for me, a very important factor in deciding, yeah, that I want to go to Germany.
Yeah, I could not agree more. That is, I think, the single most important part when you decide where you're next going. Or if you're for your PhD, it's the people that matter more than anything else.
So in the end, I can also very, very much advise everyone who considers to do a PhD or to move lab, really invest time into figuring out, is the place that you're going to a fun place? Is that something where you want to work not 40 hours per week, but maybe even a little bit more or a lot more? Is that going to give you the satisfaction that you need to keep going? That is an answer. That's a question to which the answer should be yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been on both sides of that, and it is horrible if you're on the wrong side of that. But it is amazing if you're on the right side. It really makes a huge difference. But the other thing you've done, you've not just moved countries and labs. You also seem to be moving from physics into biology, which
slowly,
to me would be a bigger jump.
Slowly, I'm moving from physics to biology. Yes, so my master was in physics. My master project was nanophotonics. For my PhD, I did a little bit of biophysics. Soft matter biophysics, basically. And now I'm with my postdoc, again, one step closer to biology. And what strikes me is how incredibly complex biology is. So there's in any case, some physicists tend to look down on biology as the dirty science, but the complexity of the questions, the complexity of the systems, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, my approach is just to assume that everything in biology can do everything. Because it usually comes out that it can eventually. We've had actually this past 2 weeks has been a great example of that. We've had we've had glycolated RNA come out recently that was discovered, and we've had a discovery of, I think it was a virus using a different genetic code, different bases. So yeah, biology just does what it wants, and we have to try and keep up with it. So how do you make that transition easier? Do you surround yourself with biologists and just immerse yourself in it?
I think that is the one and only approach, yes. You have to acknowledge that there are so many proteins with each individual functions, usually double functions, that interact with each other in non-trivial ways. And if you can accept that, that's the way to move forward. Be never afraid to ask questions. So, well, we have our heads before Corona, a shared meeting with a group that is doing biology. And their goal of a physicist should be to understand the first slide. And that might take 5 minutes, it may take 10 minutes, but try to make sure that you understand the question, that you understand basically the players in the game. And that is a big step forward. So that means that in the beginning, you will have to ask every single protein, every single organism that you encounter, there's so much to learn, and you shouldn't be afraid for that.
Yeah, I mean, even as biologists, whenever I sit in on a talk that isn't immunology or cell biology, I get completely lost. And I think people, when they present, often forget that doesn't matter who your audience is, you should be aiming for your first few slides at least to be it. Get the simple picture out there so everyone is on the same level as you talk. Yeah, I've been in some meetings where I've just been confused for a whole hour, which is not fun, actually. But presumably, all of your collaborations have really helped in doing in that kind of transition, because you seem to be somebody who collaborates quite a lot.
Yes. Yeah, so I've had a lot of collaborations in the past years, and something I really enjoy doing.
Yeah, I did my first sort of real collaboration at the start of the pandemic, and it was so much fun. That alone got me through the pandemic. So how do you find your collaborators? Are these people you're working with, or do you just approach people you'd like to work with?
Ooh, it's a mixture. So the people we work with, so we work in Münster together with a biology group, and... Well, this is again a question of two disciplines working together. Of course, we as physicists learn a lot from the biologists, but principles in physics are also, of course, applying in the world of biology. And that was the source for several collaborations there. So just basically talking to people that are in, well, sharing a lab, basically. There are also two examples where people actively approached us for instruments that we had in the lab, and where I was involved in a collaboration. And so it's both reaching out and just collaborations that naturally arise.
Yeah, I found all mine just randomly reaching out to people I kind of roughly maybe kind of knew, and thankfully they all said yes. Otherwise, I'd have been stuffed. So I mean, you know, collaborating is fun. Helpful for a career. So how do you, so in the UK, again, UK centric, sorry, but in the UK we're starting to see funding bodies take a look at how they award grants, for example. So grants traditionally are awarded to a single PI, but we're starting to see them look at that and say, well, actually that's probably not the best way of doing it. We should be maybe awarding it to joint PIs and multiple people. Is that something you're seeing? Well, on the continent, I guess, because you've been to more countries, you've worked in more countries than I have.
It's not something I've been aware of. So all grants I've seen and also applied to are granted to an individual person. What I would love to see in the future is where two people would team up and form a group together to combine strengths and preferences of one person with the strengths and preferences of another person. So to not have one superhuman who is great at both teaching, at grant writing, at designing research, at, well, you name it, but have two people combining strengths and moving forward in that way. That's something I am not aware of if that exists. Maybe it does. I would have to look it up, but that would for me be a very attractive perspective.
I mean, it doesn't exist here yet either. They're just thinking about it, which means in about 20 years we'll have a document about how they're going to do it, and then maybe another 10 years we'll actually see it in action.
Well, and then likely only one one example where the rest is just business as usual.
Yeah, yeah. Very slow change. But I agree. I think that is the ideal way of running labs these days. We're kind of expected to know so many different things and be experts on everything, and it's just not possible. So last kind of round up questions. Just generally, how have you found academia as a job, as a working environment? Is it something you recommend to other people?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Well, yes and no. Yes, I love academia. That's one of the reasons I'm doing it myself. I think that if you are passionate about a certain topic, it is a great way of going into so much detail that you would not get in any different environment. In non-academic research environment, there is still science going on, but projects that last for years rather than months are very rare. So that is, of course, if you want that, if you think you have the passion for that, and, well, also in a sense the perseverance, then absolutely, I think academia is a very, very good, well, you call it a job. I call it maybe even a lifestyle. But academia certainly has its flaws. And, well, one of them we discussed today, that's funding. I also think that academia is not always honest in what it tries to achieve. So it claims to solve cancer, the energy problem, you name it. And in the end, many people are just curiosity driven. So that's something that you must at the same time be willing to play the game. And the game is not always placed fairly. The rules are not always kind. So that's something that you should be aware of.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it is much more of a lifestyle than a job. I think it's hard to do as a job and keep it that way. Because it is, maybe it's that kind of freedom, right? Because you're free to come up with things and to work on what you want to work on, it kind of means you don't switch off. You're always thinking about things you want to work on and cool ideas, and it can be sometimes difficult to separate that out.
The best ideas are the ideas where you think about in the shower, where during breakfast you make tiny notes. So, yes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, in terms of trying to make the system a little bit fairer, I think preprints are quite useful in that. They seem to be having a nice little dent on that whole system a bit, because they do tend to make things a bit fairer. You know, you can, if you're an early career researcher, you don't have to have that money to pay the article processing charges, which are obscene. We paid, a couple of months ago, we paid something like 2,500, 3,500 for APCs. It was ridiculous.
Those are the regular fees that you're facing, yes. And the alternative is to put your paper behind a paywall.
Exactly. Which I don't think anybody really wants to do in science. I don't think there's anyone there who says, yeah, great, let's just put this out there and not care who can access it. Because ultimately, we want people to read our work, right? It's not like our thesis where we appreciate nobody might not read it. But when we do a paper, we really want people to read it. And having it behind any kind of paywall limits that.
Yes.
Yeah, they help.
Well, and then there's also the matter of funding. So what we are doing, or in any case what I'm doing, is paid by basically taxpayers' money. How fair is it if that research then disappears behind the paywall?
Yeah, which is the big argument that I think has helped shift publishers to move away from the default being behind a paywall to now the default being we pay so everyone can access our article.
What I'm currently seeing is that there is both the gold open access and the regular subscription based articles being published at the same time. So universities are paying double in a sense. So we're still far away from this ideal world.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I think we are in that transition phase where, as you said, everything's going on and it's a fortune at the moment. A lot of wasted money, I imagine, in the system, which is a shame. We could pay for so many postdocs and PhD students with that money. And then not give them jobs because there's no jobs. But, you know, we can pay for them for a few years.
Well, and then we come back to what we discussed earlier about who is funding and what initiatives there are for changing the running system.
Yeah. Okay, I think that is all of my questions.
Yeah, was a very nice experience.
Good. We
and a relaxed atmosphere, that's important.
That's what we aim for. That is. So I when I give a talk, my metric of a successful talk is whether or not the audience laughs. If I get a laugh, then the talk is a success. Doesn't matter if they listen to what I've said. They can walk away not having a clue what I actually do. As long as I make them laugh. As long as they're laughing with me, not at me. But yeah, the kind of same mentality comes into here. We hope it's just nice and chill and relaxed. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks to the three of you. It was very nice. I'm very honored to be the first guest.
Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.